Welcome to the Real Clear Politics Takeaway for Friday, January 27th. I'm Andrew Walworth. This week, President Biden announced that the U.S. would provide M1 Abrams tanks to Ukraine, escalating America's involvement in the war and helping assure that Germany would also supply tanks. It's a complicated diplomatic dance that put the president at odds, not just with some Republicans, but with military experts inside his own administration. We'll talk about that, and we'll look at Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, who is engaged in his own war with Donald Trump and Trump's disciples within the GOP. And we'll look at Speaker Kevin McCarthy's decision to remove two key Democrats from the Select Committee on Intelligence. Joining me to talk about all this are Carl Cannon, Washington Bureau Chief, A.B. Stoddard, Associate Editor and Columnist, and President and Co-Founder of Real Clear Politics, Tom Bevin. So, Carl, President Biden announced he was going to send 31 tanks to Ukraine, opens the door for European countries to send their own tanks as well. And yesterday, the White House floated the idea that Biden would visit Eastern Europe next month to mark the first anniversary of the beginning of the war in Ukraine. This is escalation by any measure. So what is the president up to? And what are the risks and benefits of upping our support for Ukraine in this way?
Well, let's start with this. I mean, what Ukraine initially said it needed and wanted was not tanks, but jet fighters. The Russians have air superiority, and they were, for the better part of a year, shelling Ukrainian cities, shelling Kiev, bombing it. They're doing it again this week. When they were told they weren't doing that and had unexpected success in the ground war, they asked for tanks. The tank they wanted was the German-built Leopard 2 tank. The Germans, who have become not just liberal in the last few years, but for the last two generations, all but a pacifist country. You know, their history, they mistrust the military, they mistrust militarization, and they've tried to tame the beast within, But the logjam was broken up by President Biden, but by the British, who finally said they would relent and they would send a few of their battle tanks. They're called Challenger tanks. They said they'd send 14 of them. Poland has been wanting to send tanks all along to the Ukrainians, but those tanks are also Leopard 2, German-built. The Germans, when they sell those tanks to Poland and even to other NATO countries, there's a proviso. You can't give those to a third party unless Germany agrees. Germany had not agreed. But Britain really broke the logjam. Then German Chancellor announced that they would give 14 Leopard 2 tanks to Ukraine's, but the Ukrainians, but only under the proviso that Joe Biden, the administration, give M1 Abrams tanks. And those are really the state-of-the-art tanks. And Biden, I think he felt pressured by NATO, but also I think his instincts are to help Ukraine. He's not wanted a land war there. He's not wanted American troops there. Those tanks are hard to operate. The initial fear was it would take American advisors, American technicians to run them. President Zelensky of Ukraine came here and famously said, he said, we're smart. We can operate tanks. Give us the tanks. We can run them. And the logjam is broken. And so now Poland's probably going to give Leopards. They'd wanted, like I say, jet fighters. Then they wanted they probably need 300 tanks, but they're going to get, sounds like 50. And the calculation apparently being made there is that as long as no one crosses into Russian territory, as long as the war stays in Ukraine, this blustery talk of nuclear retaliation by the Russians is just talk. They wouldn't launch an attack on another country with nuclear weapons. That's the calculation. And, the whole world's praying that it's right.
Tom, not everyone thinks this is a good idea. Apparently, Biden's own Secretary of Defense was recommending against sending these tanks as recently as last week, I think. And these tanks won't be on the battlefield for another year. German tanks, I guess, are going to arrive in a couple months. Republicans like Senator J.D. Vance of Ohio say that sending aid to Ukraine makes us more vulnerable to threats from China. Other Republicans are against this. What say you?
Well, it's clearly an escalation. We've kind of gone through this pattern, right? Initially, Biden said, look, we're not getting involved. We're not going to provide any arms. And then, they wanted Patriot missiles. We end up giving Patriot missiles. They wanted tanks. We end up giving them tanks. They want fighter jets, as Carl mentioned. That's the next iteration. So, we can see how this has played out. We've been drawn deeper and deeper into this war. I think that's concerning for a lot of folks. The mentality has been now, and you can see this shift in the way people are talking about it. Lindsey Graham said this. Mike Pompeo might have said it also, and some others. The quickest way to end this war is to escalate and take Putin out, basically. That's the path to the quickest end to the war. There's no talk of negotiation. There's no talk of of armistice or detente or any of that stuff. There's no negotiating going on. In fact, there hasn't been. The administration really has not done much by way of trying to get people to the table and basically stop the hostilities. The administration's position from the beginning was, you know, we're backing Ukraine against this Russian aggression, and we will do whatever Ukraine needs to help them repel the invaders. But that has shifted to this idea that Putin has to go, and that's kind of where we're headed. And again, maybe that'll end up being the case, but it is a very dicey position to be in. To Carl's point, everybody hopes that the calculations and the analysis are true, that Putin's not going to go and use nuclear weapons. But the more pressure we put on him, perhaps the higher the likelihood that he would, with nothing to lose, do something that is considered over the line or beyond the pale.
Well, AB, what about the politics of this here at home? Politico said this week the White House thought this would play a major role in the 2024 campaign. Here's the quote: Biden aides see the war as a winning 2024 issue for the president, who has framed the conflict as a battle for democracy. True?
It's true that that's the way Biden sees it, and many Americans and many in the coalition of the West see it that way. But I think this is an interesting notion. First of all, I have told you guys, I don't think Biden should run again. And I know that they continue to plant stories saying he's going to announce a second campaign after the State of the Union. But with every cell in my body, I just cannot believe he's going to announce a campaign to run for re-election. I can't believe it. And so that is my first point. In terms of the popularity of the war, I had the privilege of being in a meeting with a high-ranking foreign policy national security official in the Biden administration about 6 months ago and just said, look, you know, have you guys given up on the American people? Biden never talks about this war. Everyone had their Ukrainian flags out, you know, in February, March, and April, and May. And then what happened? And they basically said, you know, we have to do what we have to do. And so they can find some polls where Americans support weaponry for Ukraine and, of course, keeping our troops out of Ukraine. But I think this discomfort that Tom describes is real. Future fights over funding are going to be problematic, even though there will be bipartisan consensus for supporting more. It's not that it won't pose political problems. So I actually don't see it as like one of his winning. I see exactly the power of the argument for supporting the Ukrainians. And Biden truly believes, and I agree with him, that if you yield to Putin here, you yield to him everywhere. And it is true at the same time, on the other hand, that Americans don't really know what is our objective there. How do you define our objective and how do you define victory? It's very challenging. And I don't think it's an easy bumper sticker re-election campaign message at all.
Can I just add, I mean, as far as the 2024 election goes, it's going to be fascinating. I mean, you really do have, in some respects, the Democrats are now the pro-war party and the Republicans are the anti-war party. There is this idea, as AB just said, with regard to Putin, that we have to fight him here. This is a place where we have to take a stand. Otherwise, you know, all the dominoes are going to fall in Eastern Europe, which sounds awfully similar to the argument that was made in Vietnam, which sounds awfully similar to the argument that George W. Bush made in invading Iraq. We got to fight him over there so we don't fight him here. It's going to be fascinating because there is a real split within the Republican Party on this issue, and that is going to be part of the GOP primary. And then obviously it's going to it'll be part of the general election campaign.
Let me jump in there, Andy. If we're going to use historical analogies, we could use the Middle East or we could use Southeast Asia. We could also use Europe. The analogy that to my mind is more relevant and certainly geographically closer is the English and the French, Americans didn't want to fight Germany in Czechoslovakia. They didn't want to fight him even in the Balkans. They didn't want to fight him in the Sudetenland. He kept gobbling up countries till we had to fight him. So if I'm not going to blame Tom. If J.D. Vance thinks that Vladimir Putin is going to stop at the Donbass, I'd sure like to hear the evidence for that. Nobody in Europe believes this. The Lithuanians don't believe it.
So you think he's Hitler?
Well, he's behaving exactly like Hitler, Tom. The Moldovans don't believe it. He's gobbling up this territory, one pretense of another. He's even using the exact arguments Hitler used, just changed the proper nouns. I'm protecting the ethnic Russians in Ukraine. That's what Hitler said. He was protecting the ethnic Germans in the Sudetenland. I'm not a warmonger. I'm not a neocon. I'm not a neoliberal. I'm not a neo-anything. I'm just saying that if we're going to use these historical analogies, the one that's on the minds of the Europeans, and it took a lot for Britain to want to give those tanks, it took a lot for Germany to get away from its own history. The fear is that why would he stop in eastern Ukraine? What's the evidence for this? What's even the case for that? Putin doesn't even talk like that. Putin himself talks about reconstituting the Soviet Empire. This is what he says, not what some warmonger in the Biden administration says. That's what Putin says.
Well, let's talk about a conflict closer to home. And that's, AB, you wrote about one this week. This was Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. This was a piece yesterday in RCP. I highly recommend it. It was called The Party of Mitch. I'll just quote one of your lines. I like this one. It said, to put it nicely, McConnell is largely alone on an island in the Republican Party, an outcast. And after a midterm debacle that should have made him majority leader but didn't, McConnell doesn't seem to care. How did he get so out of step with the rest of the party? And what happens next?
Well, it's so interesting, Andy, because there was a very tough period for Mitch McConnell after Donald Trump lost the election. And he said that the former president should exhaust every legal avenue he had while Trump was saying that the election was stolen all through November and December 2020. You get December 14th, and that's the certification of the Electoral College votes across the states and the country. And Biden says Joe Biden has won the Electoral College majority, and he's going to be he's president-elect. I think that's the last time he and Trump ever speak. Then, you know, the rest is history. Mitch McConnell did not gather the 17 votes against President Trump in his second impeachment trial to convict him and make sure he was never a candidate for high office again. He buckled and gave some speech about how terrible and culpable Trump was, but did not vote to convict him, and went along his way hoping, and this was serious, you know, in McConnell world, that the 2022 midterms was the opportunity to vanquish Trumpism and get rid of him once and for all, because they hadn't, of course, on February 13th of 2021. So he starts out and he's on the opposite side of a bunch of races with Trump. I mean, from Trump. But he folded on Herschel Walker in Georgia. And so they have their different picks. And it's a battle in these primary campaigns. And Trump's endorsees don't all do well, but enough of them get nominated and then they don't win. And along the way, McConnell goes from trying to stave off disaster in these primaries to then actually trying to bail out the members of the circus sideshow who won the primaries between the months of August and November of 2022, spends $238 million to Donald Trump's like $14 million, and is now, after they lost and McConnell is furious, he only had one seat to pick up to become majority leader. Instead, the Democrats picked up one seat, and they lost a bunch of winnable races. So McConnell is over it. He doesn't care who he has to battle. He wants to win. And this map in 2024 is terrific for Republicans. Democrats have to defend 23 seats. Republicans, I believe, just 11. But the opportunities, the pickup opportunities are great. They're in red states and purple states. And it should go very well. Unless, of course, MAGA Nation nominates a bunch of clowns again. So McConnell does not care that he, you know, would be considered, always at the negotiating table, the indispensable man. He's like watching the House Republicans and saying, good luck to you guys on this debt ceiling thing and all your other troubles. Like, just have a nice life, because I'm over here in a Democratic Senate and nothing can pass here that you would like. So, like, you're on your own. And during the speaker battle, of course, he notoriously appeared with Biden, not just like wasn't saying nice things about Kevin McCarthy to the press, like Kevin should win and we should all unite as a party behind him. He was literally standing next to Joe Biden at an event for the infrastructure bill. So in Mitch McConnell language, that means F off. And he's just run out of patience for losing. And he doesn't care if he's isolated.
AB, I took that out of your I took that line out of your column, but I see you got it back in the podcast.
So it's just a very interesting thing to see as the Republican Party enters this incredibly volatile, you know, fluid stage. Right? They're like leaderless. We don't know if Trump will be the nominee. We don't know what's going on. We know that everyone will be running against the House Republicans next year. Everyone, but, you know. including the Republican nominee for president. Mitch McConnell is just, he's happy to be isolated out on his own, and he doesn't care. He doesn't care who takes over the RNC and who's more MAGA than the last person. He's done. And I think he's just going to go to combat in a way he was not comfortable doing in 22 and 21, trying to win back a damn Senate majority for the Republicans.
So, Tom, is it Mitch McConnell unleashed? Is that what we're looking at for the next 2 years?
Fear the turtle. Here he comes. You know, it is fascinating the way that this has gone for Mitch McConnell. When Donald Trump was in office, you know, there was all this talk of Cocaine Mitch, and he was just jamming through, you know, judiciary picks. And he was really had this aura about him that he was a warrior for Trump. And he got a lot of positive publicity. And then, you know, it just turned on him. And there's hardly when I'm sure, AB, you feel like whenever I tweet about Mitch McConnell or write about him, there is such vitriol from the Republican rank and file and from the MAGA movement toward Mitch McConnell. It's just, it's overwhelming. And, you know, Trump plays into that and he does it in the worst way. These tweets about Coco Chow, his wife, Elaine Chow, he calls her Coco Chow. It's the most infantile slur that he can muster up.
It's more than infantile, but go ahead.
Yeah, not to mention racist. Yeah.
Well, yeah, no, it's, yeah, of course. It's like a schoolyard, you know, racist taunt that, I mean, it's just ridiculous. They are mortal enemies. I mean, he really does see Mitch McConnell as a guy that, you know, he wants him gone. He wants him put out to pasture, whatever you want to say. And that's a battle that, as AB points out, Mitch isn't really going anywhere for the next couple of years. And the Senate map does look pretty good for Republicans, although I would caution as you look at this map. I mean, the last map didn't look so bad for Republicans either, particularly when you had 9% inflation and $4 a gallon gas and Republicans couldn't get it done. So we'll see what happens in 2024. But it's like a UFC death match that's going on between Trump and his wing of the party and Mitch McConnell, who's increasingly, you know, representing a smaller piece of the, you know, what's left of the Republican establishment in the Senate.
There's something else going on with McConnell too. And that is Democrats, a few of them are very reluctantly reassessing McConnell. And this hasn't gotten much attention yet, but you know, he was the person that before Trump came along, that Democrats loved to hate the most. They would always reprise this quote from his, you know, garbled it and taken out of context about how the goal of the Republicans should be to make sure Obama's a one-term president. And they thought he epitomized everything that's wrong with Washington. And, you know, they went to his house and his people forget this. His life was threatened, not Antifa, but like rank and file Kentucky Democrats went to his house, even after the other Kentucky senator was physically assaulted in his own yard by a Democrat. They kept it on. And suddenly this is slightly muted and you're not hearing this as much. And it's an interesting thing. It reminds me, you know, Barry Goldwater was considered when he was in the Senate, you know, by any good liberal, a right-wing lunatic. Ronald Reagan was routinely denounced, you know, as a racist warmonger. Well, now Barry is considered a great statesman. And Reagan is a guy who liberal Democrats, forgetting everything they ever said when he was alive, will tell you, oh, he ignited our better angels. But those two guys had to die. And Mitch McConnell is still alive, and the Democrats are going to have to try, as he goes to war with Trump, I'm curious to see how they reassess McConnell while he's there.
Well, Tom, I want to switch to the House for a minute here and talk about what's going on in this other branch of government. Kevin McCarthy decided he would not allow Eric Swalwell and Adam Schiff to continue serving on the House Intelligence Committee. So what's behind this decision? And again, is this just trench warfare that's going to continue in the House?
Yes. I think it is. I think it's a little bit of, you know, political payback, obviously, that was set by Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats when they stripped folks from their committee assignments, Republicans from their committee assignments. And
this was Marjorie Taylor Greene and
Paul Gosar, correct. Look, I think Democrats, for all the talk about Republicans breaking norms, busting norms over the last few years, you know, Democrats did their own share of busting norms. Particularly in the House of Representatives. And I think so this is part of the tit for tat, although I thought Kevin McCarthy actually defended it pretty well. You know, he had this exchange with this reporter the other day and said, listen, you know, He gave his reasoning for why he would not, you know, Eric Swalwell, he said he's got an FBI briefing. Obviously, he was involved with a Chinese spy for a while. Swalwell claims that he's been cleared and there was no wrongdoing. And also Adam Schiff, you know, and what he did as chairman of the Intel committee to leak and lie to the American public about what was going on with the Russia investigation. He said, listen, there are 200 other plus Democrats that can serve on this committee. You know, choose one of them. I'm just saying these two cannot. And by the way, I'm not saying they can't serve on any committees. They just can't serve on this one. So I think it's a solid argument that he makes, and he's justified in making it. The Democrats obviously don't like it and are upset with it. But by and large, from his perspective, it's a very justifiable decision.
So, AB, you know, one big difference is that this intelligence committee, it's a select committee, and he can it's up to him who he decides to put on the committee or not. These other examples required a vote from the majority of the House, and so sort of different categories from that point of view, right?
Exactly. And it takes a vote of the House, and some Republicans joined to oppose those committee assignments for Gosar and Green. Now you actually have some Republicans who are saying that they might oppose their speaker in trying to block Ilhan Omar in a full vote of the House from the Foreign Relations Committee. But you're right about Swalwell and Schiff. That's a select committee on intelligence, and that is the prerogative of the speaker. And Tom's right that after Nancy Pelosi sort of started this, I just think it's the kind of thing in our tribal country that is now expected and is just a casualty of our politics. And I don't know that voters are going to remember, particularly after all the other things they're likely to remember at the 118th Congress's end. I don't think they're going to remember that McCarthy did this, because I don't think it's going to stand out. So I don't think he's going to take a political hit over it.
Well, Carl, this is a legacy of your pal Nancy Pelosi, who you defend on this podcast with some regularity. I'm just wondering.
That doesn't mean they're pals.
Well, I'm just saying, how does this fit into her legacy?
Well, Pelosi and I aren't pals, although her political patron saint in Democratic politics, Phil Burton, was my godfather, and I've known her. She's from San Francisco, so I've known her a long time. We're not pals, but I defend her. I think she was a, by and large, an effective speaker, but there are certain unfortunate precedents that she set. The one that I think of, and I certainly hope Kevin McCarthy doesn't repeat it in the State of the Union address, is ripping up Trump's speech as the cameras were on her. I mean, that was really a gratuitous thing to do. She prevented Jim Jordan and this other guy, AB will remember his name, from being on the January 6th committee.
Jim Jordan and Jim Banks are both involved in January 6th, and she had every right to say that they, because they're basically witnesses, that they shouldn't be on the committee. And as we've discussed before, the great gift to Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats was that McCarthy had a huffy fit and said, fine, no Republicans on the committee. And that was the best thing to happen to the committee.
I agreed with that, AB, but I'd suggest to you that if the committee was really going to be an honest committee, you wouldn't have Schiff on it. I mean, he declared himself, he'd led the impeachment. You know, you wouldn't have these people who'd been impeachment managers on it either. But be that as it may,
I'm going to let Carl finish his point. I don't think you can investigate January 6th with Jordan and Banks on the committee. I have to agree with her there.
But the point is that this is payback. And Swalwell and Schiff are probably the two Democrats in the House that Republicans dislike the most. They find them offensive. They don't think they're honest. They think they grandstand all the time. They really have it in for them. This idea that Swalwell isn't to be trusted with national secrets because a Chinese spy once served as an intern in his office, that seems a stretch to me, frankly. And Schiff, you know, leaking to reporters and exaggerating all the evidence against Trump, it's a little closer to maybe you wouldn't want a guy in the Intelligence Committee, but really it's payback is what it is. And you always hope, this hope never is realized, that, okay, that'll be the end of it. Now they're even. Now McCarthy doesn't have to tear up Trump's or Biden's State of the Union speech. The next time Democrats are in Congress, they don't have to retaliate. You hope that the point has been made. And I guess I'll leave it there, because hope springs eternal on this podcast.
Well, I think that's a good point. We'll leave this on. Hope does spring eternal, and spring will come. That's the other thing I was thinking today. It was a little warmer today out here on the Eastern Shore. You can start to hear the birds. Spring is around the corner. So I want to thank Tom Babin, A.B. Stoddard, and Carl Cannon. We're usually here Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays in some form, so bookmark this podcast. Come back often. You can keep up with what we're doing here at the podcast by signing up for the free RCP Takeaway newsletter from Real Clear Politics. And you can also sign up for Carl Cannon's Morning Note, which will then magically appear in your inbox. Both of these make excellent Valentine's gifts for that special someone in your life. And as usual, I urge you to go to Real Clear Politics. Read one article from a writer or publication with whom you disagree. That may be A.B. Stoddard this week. You never know. Thank you for listening. Until next time, for Real Clear Politics, I'm Andrew Walworth.